Coming up, Tom Haberschor and I talk about the Thunder evening things up in the Western Conference Finals with a Game 2 victory over the Spurs. And then we get into Cavs, Knicks, Cleveland blowing that Game 1. Just, I can't get over it. Game 2 tonight, we talk about that, potential adjustments on both sides, as well as some news around the NBA regarding the Timberwolves, the Mavericks, and what the Bucks might be thinking with Giannis Antetokounmpo. That's all coming up right now. Welcome back to the Evan O'Connor Show. NBA playoffs are happening. To talk about it all, Tom Haberschor. What's up, Tom?
What's up, Kev? How's it going, man?
I'm doing pretty good, man. The Thunder and Spurs are now tied up 1-1 after Oklahoma City won Game 2 last night in a very physical game. People online complaining, and understandably so, about some of the aggression and the fouling, the hair pulling. But I do want to start off talking about just some of the pure basketball adjustments that led to this win for Oklahoma City. I think the big one, Tom, very clearly, and the one that's getting a lot of attention, is after Game 1, Isaiah Hartenstein barely played at all in the game. His minutes were matched against Luke Kornet. And Game 2, right from the opening possession, Hart was defending Wemby. Hartenstein had 8 offensive boards in the game, very aggressive, physical, very much like the Wolves did last round against the Spurs, against Victor Wembanyama. What were your overall thoughts on that adjustment? How surprised were you that OKC did go this route as well? Because it did seem to work and flustering San Antonio.
Oh, yeah. This was a huge adjustment by Mark Daigneault, because you consider the fact that he only defended Wemby for 8 possessions in the regular season. In 3 games, that matchup, when they were on the floor, Hartenstein just did not guard Wemby. That was not the alignment. And in Game 1, he barely guarded him. And when you see the numbers here, 41 possessions that Isaiah Hartenstein guarded Wemby in this game. And in the previous 4 matchups this season, all losses for OKC, they basically avoided that matchup entirely. And the big reason why is because they prefer to have smaller guards, whether it's Alex Caruso, Lou Dort, or J-Dub. And without J-Dub in this game, they did not have that option a lot of the throughout the game. But really, this was an adjustment from the get-go. And they wanted more physicality. They wanted him to stay out of the paint, play with more physicality, and also keep him off the boards. And it worked. I mean, you look at what happened, Kev, in Game 1, where Victor Wembanyama had 18 shots at the rim, a career high 18 shots around the basket. And that was a lot of the fact due to that they had Alex Caruso and smaller guards guarding him. You stick Isaiah Hartenstein, the biggest guy on this roster, and there was a lot of physicality. He was doing a lot of grabbing, but that was on purpose. He knows. I remember I was talking to an NBA league office personnel at the Sloan Conference a few years ago, and we were talking about referees, and they were saying, "Look, we can't call everything." And so, yeah, there's a gray area on what is a foul objectively and what's not a foul. And the Oklahoma City Thunder have mastered this, is that they know the referees aren't going to call everything out there. So grab, hold, pull, all you want, and just dare the officials to call it every time. And this is the playoffs. You're allowed to do that as long as the officials are calling it that way. So I don't blame the Thunder and Isaiah Hartenstein for grabbing and holding and basically steamrolling Victor Wembanyama out of the paint, because the officials allowed it. And that adjustment by Mark Daigneault gave them the victory in Game 2.
Game 1, Wemby took 48% of his shots in the restricted area. In Game 2, that dropped to 19%. And then the three-pointers reverted back the other way, inverted the other way. 8% of his shots, only 2 of them were three-pointers in Game 1, to 44% of his shots came from three-point range in Game 2. So if there's any stat, like the one you listed, just the pure raw possessions that Hartenstein defended Wemby, but then just the shot distribution for Wemby, it literally flipped the opposite way. And I think part of that, the feeling that I had after Game 1, to me, OKC felt small in Game 1. It felt like to me that Caruso, as good of a job as he did, J-Dub, as much as he fought, those guys were just allowing Wemby to get tip-ins, second chances, tip-outs, just dunking over the defense, possession after possession. Hartenstein didn't allow that. So yeah, I think that to me is going to be very interesting to see how the San Antonio Spurs end up adjusting entering game three now at home. Now, I think that's a huge part of it. I think the fact OKC is on the other end of the floor as well did a much better job of just beating the double team. San Antonio doubled SGA outside the perimeter roughly the same amount of times as they did in game one. But in game one, SGA scored, or the Thunder scored 0.9 points per double team when Shea was doubled. That went to 2.1 points per double team. I mean, just like an absurd increase. And you can see with the video just how ready every single time it seemed like OKC was, whether it was passing the ball to Caruso around the free throw line or SGA dribbling out of it, immediately making a pass out to McCain for three. They were always ready, it seemed like, for San Antonio to throw two at SGA outside the three-point line. And these little micro adjustments that OKC made between games one and two show why this is a seven-game series, Tom, because we're going to see a series of adjustments.
Yeah, you're going to see a lot of it. The game two was completely different than game one. And that's the magic of the postseason and this playoff series. I mean, we saw an all-time great game in game one. We have that stat from inpredictable.com, Mike Bowie, that tracks the win probability of every game. And you can see that the excitement factor, which he describes as if you take the win probability graph and just pulled each end of the line until it gets taut, the length of that win probability line was the longest we've seen for any playoff game in the last 5 years, and 14th in excitement in terms of like just wild fluctuations in the win probability chart. And that was 14th since 1996, one of the greatest games we've seen in the playoffs ever. And in this one, it was not as wild fluctuations. OKC was ahead for most of this game. But I do think that tactically, it was totally different as well. You saw the injuries to Jalen Williams early in this game and Dylan Harper. And I think the Dylan Harper factor, the fact that he's going for an MRI and Jalen Williams too, it's going to really change the footprint of this series in game three. And I will say, Victor Wembanyama, he's too good to allow OKC to command that offense. Defensively, Wemby's so dominant in just shrinking the floor. But a lot of those highlights you showed, he's not out there. And I think OKC did a great job of taking advantage of those non-Wemby minutes. And it's exhausting to be Wemby on both ends of the floor. In 41 points in game one, 23 paint touches, and then just five, like we mentioned earlier, just five in game two. Wonder how much of that is physicality and fatigue after all those minutes in game one. And so now they travel for game three, and there aren't guys that are able to dominate all around this game. But you're going to see, you know, without Dylan Harper, presumably, and Stephon Castle has to get better at being a playmaker, those paint touches are going to become harder to come by if there's no De'Aaron Fox in game three. So this is, you know, a Wemby opportunity here with averaging over 30 points and 20 rebounds in the first two games of the series. We haven't seen a guy do that in this late in the postseason in a two-game stretch since prime Shaq. And I think what you're going to see in game three is OKC has to continue to take advantage of those non-Wemby minutes and assert themselves. And you saw those highlights, man. Those clips, there was not a lot of dribbling. It was boom, 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 tic-tac-toe, and that's so hard to defend, especially when they're shorthanded on the Spurs side.
Absolutely. I mean, SGA was remarkable in the game, I felt like. 30 points, 24 shots, hit so many tough contested jumpers off the dribble, clutch timely shots. He had the late pull-up where Jared McCain, he said after the game, was yelling for the ball, and he said, you know, settle down after hitting a shot to push him up, I think, 7 points or something like that late in the game. But you mentioned it in passing there, Tom. Dylan Harper, now hurt, and we'll see if he's back for game three or not. It seems if he's getting an MRI, there's probably some doubt there. Stephon Castle, 20 turnovers through the first two games. He is on pace to have the most turnovers anybody has ever had in a seven-game series. And you look at just some of the sloppy, casual decisions he's made as a passer and as a ball handler. This is why, ultimately, the Spurs have De'Aaron Fox on their roster and why they drafted Dylan Harper, right? And this relates to kind of where I was off with this roster. Castle is more of the Andre Iguodala. He's the off-ball guy. He cannot be your primary creator, at least this early in his career, maybe someday, but nowhere close right now. I mean, he stepped on the timeline at the half court for a backcourt violation, and just some of the passes were just so off. And I think for the Spurs, this is a problem, and it's why they need Fox back very badly in this series. On my Tuesday pod, I talked about how OKC won the turnover battle 28-17 in game one. It was 27-10 in game two. So now for the series, points off turnovers are in favor of Oklahoma City, 55-27. 55-27 points off turnovers. San Antonio's got to clean it up. And De'Aaron Fox has to be a big part of that, especially if Dylan Harper is out. Let's just assume he's out at least for the next 2-3 games. It can't just be Castle, or this is suddenly going to be 2-1, 3-1 in all likelihood. They need Fox back and looking like the De'Aaron Fox that can be an all-star caliber player in game three, or this could potentially get ugly and turn back the other way towards Oklahoma City totally.
Yeah, that dunk was remarkable, but we have to look at this entire dude, Stephon Castle.
He's out, Tom, he's out for blood with like some of those dunks, the two-footed leaps. He is so explosive, but then he makes these mistakes. It's very Russell Westbrook-esque where it's like, oh my God, he's amazing. Oh my God, what are you doing?
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's very Russell Westbrook-esque where it's just the athleticism and the fierceness where it's just, he has no regard for human life in the very Kevin Harlan sense where he's going up there against Isaiah Hartenstein and does not care. He does not give an F about who's in front of him, and he just rises above. What I love about this dunk, especially
Shea Gilgeous-Alexander's look there.
Sometimes when guards go up against these poster, the poster dunks against these bigs, they use their offhand as kind of like pushing down on the defender. Stephon Castle had his chest out. He had his chest out in this and had his offhand back, and he just rose above and flushed it over Isaiah Hartenstein. My dog was sitting there on the rug in my living room while I'm watching this game. And just jumped up into the ceiling. I felt so bad. I scared the living daylights out of my dog. And look, like when you look at Stephon Castle in this moment, he's a superstar. But with the 9 turnovers, 11 in game one, it reminds me in the regular season among players with at least 750 drives. So there's 31 players, high volume drivers in the NBA. We're talking the Shea Gilgeous-Alexanders, the Denny Avdias, the Russell Westbrooks, the Jalen Brunsons of the world. Of the 31 high-volume drivers in the regular season, Stephon Castle had the highest turnover rate on those drives at 9.9% in the regular season. So one out of every 10 drives, he is going to cough up the ball. And it wasn't even close. The next highest guy on that list was Denny Avdia at 7.3%, and Stephon Castle's at 10%. So we're talking about a guy who's routinely in the regular season, when he is trying to go through the trees, he has a tendency to get rid of the cough up the ball. And against OKC, the piranhas, as Amin El-Hassan talked about it earlier this week on Basketball Illuminati, where he was like, it's like piranhas when guys drive into the teeth of the defense. The Thunder love that. And Stephon Castle is playing into the hands of OKC's defense, where it seems like he doesn't have a roadmap, what he wants to do. And he's just coughing up the ball. And it does seem like he's overwhelmed in this series as the primary ball handler. Nothing against him because he's 21 years old in his first deep postseason run. But when you look at the numbers, when De'Aaron Fox is not playing, Stephon Castle's numbers, the turnover ratio skyrockets. He's averaging over 5 turnovers a game in the 12 games in which De'Aaron Fox does not play. And that number dwindles down to under 4 when he does play with De'Aaron Fox. So playing off ball is where he's a superstar. And in this moment, because it's the playoffs, man, This is do or die for Stephon Castle. You see the numbers here, 19 points a game without De'Aaron Fox in uniform and just about 6 turnovers a game. And the assist numbers, he can get you double digit assists in every game. But it's those mistakes where a lot of percentage of those, a high percentage of those are live ball turnovers, and that's why those numbers are so crazy on those points off the turnovers, like you said.
One of the other things that I think OKC deserves a lot of credit for and San Antonio needs to resolve is those non-Wemby minutes. Through the two games, San Antonio is a plus 15 in Wemby's 86 minutes. OKC is a plus 17 in the 20 Cornette minutes. They're outscoring the Spurs 56-39. And you could just, like, you just use your eyeballs and you just see the way they attack and attack and attack Cornette, and the way the Spurs offense just kind of falls apart without Wemby's gravity out there, without his presence opening up so much for everybody else. I wonder, is there a chance we see San Antonio move away from Cornette and just go super small in the non-Wemby minutes? Carter Bryant at the five, just completely space it out, switch one through five, everything, because they said Cornette earlier in the week, I think it was before game one, Mitch Johnson said Cornette and Fox are going to be dealing something for as long as this goes, Cornette with a foot injury. I don't know if that's all to blame. I mean, this has been a thing, whether he's been healthy or not in the non-Wemby minutes. But I do wonder if we see at some point they just pull the plug on Cornette and go full switching 1-5. And I know that brings up other potential issues. You still might not be able to stop penetration. You still don't have size in the paint. OKC then might have an even greater advantage. I'm not saying it would work, but the Cornette minutes are not working. And OKC is creating, overcoming the difference, whether they're winning or losing or staying pretty close to even in the Wemby minutes, which they did in game two. I think San Antonio might have to switch that up. What do you think, Tom?
I'm with you. And Luke Cornette, he's not nasty enough or has a mean streak enough to settle a lot of the scores out there. Like, if you're not going to have Wemby out there, you want someone like Isaiah Stewart, who's going to come in there and be an enforcer on a lot of the dirty plays that OKC, or at least the grabbing and the pushing. There's no enforcer on the Spurs roster. And as a backup center, I kind of hope that Cornette would be able to settle a lot of those things and be a lot more physical. Not that he needs to be dirty, but, like, there's a reason why James Johnson's on the Indiana Pacers roster, right? There's a reason why Isaiah Stewart, despite all of his suspensions and fines, they love having that guy out there, because if you're going to be playing, prison ball out there, then Isaiah Stewart is ready for this. And I think the Spurs, in a weird way, they don't have that guy. Bismack Biyombo is not that guy. Luke Cornette is not that guy. Harrison Barnes certainly isn't.
I know who. Kelly Olynyk. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh. Yeah, kidding. The shoulder shredder himself. Yes. It's weird to say, right, that the Spurs are too nice, because that's certainly not the brand of basketball that Dylan Harper and Stephon Castle play. Those guys are hoopers. Those guys are out for blood, like you said. But I do think that somebody on the Spurs has to respond with the physicality and the tactics by the Thunder. And it's not going to be Luke Cornette. He's not that guy. And if he's gimpy with the foot issue, he's not going to be as mobile as you want him to be. And so if you're not going to get that goon enforcer, Udonis Haslem, who he doesn't take anything from anybody, they got to come up with a different way to equalize those minutes without Wemby.
All right, you mentioned prison ball. This has been one of the big stories coming out of the game, which in some ways I think is unfortunate, because I think from a tactical standpoint, this has been a fascinating series. Like, I'm very glad we spent so much time just talking about some of the adjustments Oklahoma City made. I think it's an unbelievable series from that standpoint and could even get better moving forward. However, Isaiah Hartenstein did tug at Stephon Castle's dreads. There were plenty of instances in which SGA did fall on the ground after making his jumpers. And this has been one of the predominant stories regarding the Thunder for going back to last season with the flopping and all that. I do think, Tom, it's a little bit of bias against Oklahoma City. As if you're watching on YouTube, the play on screen, you can see Wemby tugging at Hartenstein's arm on an offensive board opportunity. There's a lot of those instances as well in the game. Personally, the way I feel about this is that I like physicality. I think the physicality is overall a good thing. SGA only had 6 free throws in the game. I like the fact they weren't rewarding this type of behavior for the most part. I think there are instances in which you could see Stephon Castle bumping against SGA. And I'm like, thank goodness they weren't calling these fouls where Castles were very aggressively defending SGA on the outside, grabbing at his arm. It's like, I like this. I like this physicality. And I hope they continue allowing this, continue swallowing their whistles. However, Tom, I do understand the fans who look at stuff like the Harrison Barnes foul that happened after Barnes grabbed an offensive board at one point, and he kicked it back out to, I think it was Champagne, if I remember correctly. And then Isaiah Joe, woo, just flopped his way to the ground, barely got touched, and they blew the whistle on Barnes for an offensive foul at the end of the second quarter. Plays like that, to me, that's where the NBA needs to just start levying out heavy fines against players and teams. Get that out of the game. To me, those are the plays. You got to get that out. Those plays, get them out. The physicality, I don't care about Hartenstein bumping against Wemby and the grabbing and all that. I like that. I want that. I want SGA to get checked outside. I don't want flopping and falling to get rewarded, and that needs to be penalized and get it out. To me, that's the way I came away with it. I'm curious about your thoughts, Tom. Maybe I'm being a little unfair to the people who are anti-Oklahoma City in this. I don't know. What do you think?
It would be such a win for Adam Silver and the organization, the league office, to just fine Isaiah Joe, just to fine some of the players for those flopping antics. Like the hand, it's not that he fell. It's that he flung his arms out and then went down to the ground like he got shot in the leg. Like, no, like he tripped up. There's barely any contact with Harrison Barnes. And he knew, hey, Julius Champagne's got a wide open three. I can't get out to him, so I'm just going to try to get the foul call. He gets the foul call and wipes away a three in a critical part of the game. So it's easy money for the NBA to just fine a guy in that moment, and I think you would see a lot fewer flops in the postseason, especially with all these eyeballs on the league and these huge audiences that we're seeing for OKC and San Antonio and the Knicks games. Like, I think the NBA, it's like found money here for them if they just hand out a couple fines here and there. I will say, there are a couple posts I saw that got huge traffic, millions and millions of views about how Shai Gilgeous-Alexander was flopping on every single one of his shots. And it prompted me to go, Kev, and chart every single one of his field goal attempts in this
series.
Thank
you for doing this.
How many times did Shai Gilgeous-Alexander fall on his jumper or in the lane, whatever? I counted 47 field goal attempts.
And this isn't both games, to be clear. Both games
both
so
games,
far.
Both games, 47 field goal attempts in this series for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. And I charted how many times he was on his feet at the end of that field goal attempt or whether he was on the ground and fell. And by the Twitter or NBA Twitter, you would assume, or on Instagram, the social media conversation is that he's falling every single time. And the answer is, of those 47 field goal attempts by Shai Gilgeous-Alexander in this series, he fell 13 times out of 47. So that is 28% of the time. More than half, the vast majority of the shots, he's not flopping, he's not flailing, he's landing on his 2 feet. And yes, there are times where it seems like he's exaggerating contact, but that's true for every star, every superstar in the league. And there are egregious examples for sure when it comes to Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. It's just up to the NBA to penalize him. And I would also say 13 out of 47, he had 5 falls out of 23 shots in game 1, 8 falls out of 24 shots in game 2. So if we're talking about a guy flopping and flailing, let's just get the facts right. He has fallen on 13 out of 47 shots. And if you want to look at Joel Embiid or Jalen Brunson, it's going to be the best scorers in the NBA are also falling in a comparable amount of times.
Taylor in the chat asked, how many of the falls include a foul? Do you happen to have that handy by any chance?
Yeah, I mean, I think he had 8 out of the 13 were called fouls. And so he gets a foul call on a lot of them, but because there's a lot of contact, he had his feet taken out. But there's a lot of times, like you said, Kev, they're not rewarding him for those flops or those foul calls, much as you would think. It's not every time that he falls, he gets a call. But I just want to get the numbers out there, the facts straight, is that the vast majority, 70% of the time that Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is scoring on the Spurs, he's not relying on officials. He's just balling out and hitting the shots.
And we'll be right back after this break. I saw a funny post after game one. It was a Sixers fan saying, "Is this how we sound?" And it was in response to a Spurs fan explaining why Wemby falls to, you know, avoid, you know, full contact with his feet and his knees, just to like just to disperse the impact of the landing. And that was a Sixers fan saying, "Is that how we sound?" I think there's an element of that where I saw a few Thunder fans saying the same thing after game two with SGA. He's doing this because you're in his landing zone. He's falling to avoid it so he doesn't turn an ankle. I think, as you said, Tom, every star flops. Every star flails around. SGA might do it to a greater extreme, and I do think there's an element with the Thunder where, like I said, with that Isaiah Joe play, to me, that was the worst flop of the two games so far. And that those are the plays the NBA needs to eliminate entirely. You need to make it so there's no incentive or reward for doing that rubbish. Just get rid of it. Like, fine the guy $500K, not $50,000. Fine him a lot of money so it hurts. Like, whatever the amount is. That's what the league needs to get rid of. But the SGA thing, I'm very glad you tracked that. I was thinking about that this morning. I didn't have time to do it with all the other prep and the other draft stuff I'm getting prepared. But we were thinking along the same lines. Watch every shot. See how many times he lands on 2 feet. What was the number? 13 out of 47, Tom? Is that the number?
Yeah, 13 out of 47 he fell after his shot. So the other way to think about it is 34 out of 47, he's just on his own 2 feet. And so that doesn't sound like something we should be, you know, throwing a parade for.
No.
But I would also say the NBA should add this to their stat profile of all these players. We have player tracking technology. We should have fall rates. We should have an ability to track whether this shot was, you know, what percentage of a player's field goal attempts he's on his own 2 feet or falling onto the ground. And I do think, Kev, in a weird way, I think that would also dissuade players from doing it all the time. If that was a stat that was commonly tracked, I think people would be like, if people are chatting more about how often they fall on their jumpers, I think they would be less inclined to do it. So I think it would be a good deterrence if the NBA tracked fall percentage. Here it is. I'm campaigning for fall percentage to be added to the NBA.com stats because I think it would be a deterrent for players to flop as much as they are.
It's so good. I had earlier in the week when I had Michigan head coach Dusty May in the podcast, I asked him, "Oh, do you college teams have the camera tracking data for your teams?" And he's like, "No, it's too many arenas, all that. Hopefully someday." And you know, I just talked to him about how, like, with the X, Y, and now Z coordinates from the tracking data, the Z coordinates tracking body parts and all that, the NBA has the tools to create this false stat that you're proposing here, Tom. Mm-hmm. It could be falls off of jumpers, total falls in games, falls off of rebound opportunities.
I mean, I watched Dwayne Wade covering him, and it is the same thing with Joel Embiid. Is there is a strategy of it does the land? It's not jumping that breaks down your joints; it's your landing. And they like teams will track how many there are teams in the NBA that ban dunking in practice because they don't want excessive or unnecessary landing, like dunks in the landing and the force when you land on the hardwood, it deteriorates your joints. And so for Joel Embiid, Victor Wembanyama, Dwayne Wade later in his career, it was a strategy to lessen the force and the carnage on those joints, the bone on bone. When you talk about Dwayne Wade and all the meniscus, you know, removals that he's had in his career, there is a lot of pain there when you land. And so I understand that tactically there is a strategy to fall rather than having that blunt force on your joints. But there's a lot of them with Embiid, D Wade. Mm-hmm. You talk about Jalen Brunson, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. SGA.
There's a lot. There's a lot.
Yeah. It's a lot.
Eight out of 24 is a lot. It's more than it should be, but to be fair. But it's not 24, which is your point. People said he fell on every single shot attempt. In one of my chats earlier, someone said, is that stat true? Yes, it is. People are posting about it. No, it's not true. It's actually completely false. It is a false number.
Like the one, the play, I hope we can pull it up again, the Carter Bryant, where he flipped Carter Bryant, had to do a 360. Like, are we just not acknowledging that Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is just an amazing the footwork and the craftiness is incredible. And a lot of the late game shots, he's not relying on flopping or falling. He's just shaking guys and not able, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, he's got this ability to use his footwork, and yes, he can push off a lot of times and arm bar the opponents, but it's not every time down the floor. And so I do think that it gets out of control, the conversation around Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. But like most things, it's a cliche or it's a talking point because there is a sliver of truth in it, and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander definitely gets away with a lot.
One last thing is before we transition to Knicks Cavs here. Fox dealing with the ankle injury, Dylan Harper, the quad, hamstring, whatever it is exactly, Cornette foot, J-Dub now dealing with his hamstring issue again, didn't play after the first quarter. He deleted or archived all his posts on Instagram last night, put up removed his profile photo, so he's probably in a very moody mood this morning, not feeling good, not happy. So I can't imagine it's good news there with him. He's done this before when he's not quite happy. AJ Mitchell said he's fine. He just bumped his quad. So that's probably good news for OKC.
That was assuming scary, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, that was scary. Exactly. Look, the injuries could pile up here in this series, and it's hard to talk about without word on what's going to actually happen with the return of Fox in Game 3. If Dylan Harper's going to miss time, how long J-Dub's going to be out, and all that. But I will say this, Tom, to bring us to Knicks Cavs, the longer this Spurs Thunder series goes, and it very well could go 7, it is looking like it is going to be a battle. And for the Knicks or the Cavs, if they can come out of that series clean, healthy, if the Knicks can win it in 4 or 5, and I don't think it's going to be that quick, but it could be, they get time off to rest and heal up, whereas San Antonio or Oklahoma City very well could be going into the NBA Finals all battered up from a really hard series. So let's talk about Knicks-Cavs Game 1. Look ahead to Game 2 later tonight. 44-11. Epic collapse. I still can't get over it. It took Kenny Atkinson 4 minutes to call a timeout when New York went 5 out with Landry Shamet out there. They had a hard time defending. They were attacking James Harden over and over and over again. And after the game, Kenny Atkinson talked about, I like to keep my timeouts. I don't like to get to the end of a game when it's a one or two point game and I don't have any. You had one and you didn't even use it on the Sam Merrill shot that was 3/4 of the way in. So that's, I don't get that. And then yesterday morning, Tom, he had a quote where he said, in the 4th quarter, the Knicks were in the first percentile in shot quality. We have data that you guys don't. And he's not lying about that, by the way. That's true. They were in the first percentile in shot quality in the 4th quarter. But so was Cleveland. Cleveland was too. So you got all these timeouts, and your team's clearly either rattled or confused or simply tired, and you just let it happen over and over again with Brunson attacking Harden and then Mitchell not getting touches on offense. I just still can't get over it. I would never advocate for axing a coach in the middle of a playoff series. It seems insane to do. But boy, that's the closest I've ever thought to having that thought cross my mind, Tom, where it's like, maybe they'd be better off. Because how do you get over that? That was horrible, I thought.
Yeah, look. Jalen Brunson is a 1% shot quality scorer. So I'm not surprised that when he's cooking like that, they're saying, well, look, it was tough shots. He said they got lucky. You know, like they said he got lucky. And how many times in that press conference, Kev, he said the word tough, like tough shots. They hit tough shots. Yeah, it's a tough shot that they hit. What Translation to those listening right now, when anytime you hear a player or a coach say that guy hit a tough shot, what they're really saying is lucky. He got lucky. And so when you're hearing Kenny Atkinson say after the game, hey, they had 1% shot quality in the fourth quarter, there's also metrics that have player adjusted shot quality, meaning that Jalen Brunson, when he is a great tough shot maker, lucky shot maker, when you have a guy like him, it's not 1% anymore because he's 6 foot nothing out there and he's going to get a lot of shots where it's heavily contested with bigger guys against him. And yet he's able to get 38 points. He's an anomaly. He's a guy that is an outlier that if you want to win down the stretch, you cannot let James Harden be guarding him, willingly letting James Harden guard him at 37 years old and having the vast majority of the shots taken by the Knicks in the fourth quarter and overtime were targeted against James Harden. 16 shots in the fourth quarter and overtime against James Harden. That was the game right there. Like, how did they blow the lead? How did they blow a 22-point lead in which they had a 0.02% chance of blowing it at the low point when they were up 22? It's because tactically, Mike Brown realized, oh, we've got one of the best one-on-one scorers in Jalen Brunson, one of the worst one-on-one defenders, fourth quarter, 37 years old James Harden, and they're willing to do this? Oh, we're going to it every single time, Kev.
Look, I think if you're Kenny Atkinson, you might want to keep your timeouts. You might be happy with the tough shots for Brunson, the lucky shots for Brunson, as you said, Tom. But the stats on screen that you had on your show yesterday, 16 shots defended by Harden in the fourth quarter and overtime to only 4 for Mobley, 2 for 4 other guys, 1 for 2 other players. What I am baffled by, and I would imagine Kenny Atkinson, if he was being totally honest with his thoughts, and maybe he was being honest, and he does think it's just all luck and all just it's going to work in their favor. You have Max Strus sitting on the bench for that final 7:30 in regulation. You have Harden on an island against these guys. You're not putting your best defenders. Wade played 3 of those minutes. Strus played 1 of those minutes during the final 7:30. You can bench Harden. It's okay. Like, he seemed pretty tired to me. I think Mitchell seemed pretty exhausted as well down the stretch of that game. It's okay. Like, you could have done that. I think that's where I just look at the not calling the timeout and not making the adjustments that just boggles my mind, because that's in part why the Knicks came back in the game, was because they did make an adjustment. Josh Hart in this game was a liability. The Knicks were minus 20 in his 30 minutes in the game, but they were up to this 7:30 mark in the fourth quarter with the 44-11 run. It was an even 28-28 in the 10 minutes and 43 seconds without Josh Hart up there, up until the comeback without him on the floor. And then they inserted Landry Shamet, and Landry Shamet changed everything in this game. He was hitting shots. He was playing pretty competitive on defense as well. Towards the end, when Cleveland did start doubling Brunson, they did make that adjustment very late. Mm-hmm. I thought it was if Kenny Atkinson was happy with the tough shots that Brunson was taking, I don't think you would decide to double team and lead to wide open shots for Landry Shamet and other guys on the team. And that adjustment that Mike Brown made by going 5 out, we haven't seen a lot of that with the Knicks. That's what I think fueled the comeback on top of Jalen Brunson just doing Jalen Brunson things. And I wonder, are we going to see the Knicks move away from that in game 2 a bit? Are they going to pull Hart even quicker? Because it seemed to me that Cleveland did have a good strategy for that. Jared Allen or Evan Mobley just helping off of him, basically ignoring him on the perimeter. That seems to be something that maybe could be advantage Knicks in game 2 at home now, after seeing the way Cleveland was playing them in game 1.
I still can't believe they blew that lead.
I know. I can't believe it. I was like at the point where it's like, well, I posted on X and Threads. I said, well, Donovan Mitchell was the best player on the floor tonight. This was like probably around the 8-minute mark or something, right before the run started. And then it all turned and it was, oh, wait a minute. Jalen Brunson was actually the best player on the floor tonight. I mean, you get away till the final buzzer. I can't believe it either. And that's where it's just like, Tom, if you're Cleveland, you had a chance to go up 1-0 and get your split or even possibly win both on the road again, Madison Square Garden against the favorite Knicks, and you blew it. You blew it. And this Cavs team is just, they've been like this the whole postseason. How many times have I been out on the Cavs and then they come back and have a big game? It happened in game six last round. Then they have a, they blow out the Pistons in game seven. They might blow out the Knicks tonight. I'm not ruling that out. I don't know what to expect from this team. All I know is that, yeah, on screen, we effing blew it, Donovan Mitchell said after game one. They might have lost the series by losing that lead in the fourth quarter.
Here's a stat. James Harden now has 32 playoff games in which he has more turnovers than field goals, including that game one where he had six turnovers and five made baskets. He shot 5 of 16, 1 for 8 from downtown, and had six turnovers. The Cavs are now, I think it's 0-6 in the postseason when he has these crash out games, as I've called them, and they're 8-1 when he doesn't. Kev, this is the conundrum that the Cavs face, is they are going to be they're going as far as James Harden's going to take them. If he has one of those bad games, it's over for them. They don't have the margin for error. Evan Mobley has not elevated himself to be that second scorer, you know, guy who can be a go-to scorer for them. Although I will say he's been so much better than he showed early in this postseason. He's been stronger as of late. He had an open three that did not go down, that would have been huge against the Knicks in game one. But you're talking about James Harden, who got, like, this stat here, the turnovers over field goals, that has nothing to do with his defense. So you talk about the giving away the ball, not hitting shots, and being a traffic cone defensively. This guy's making $42 million next year as a player option, and the Cavs are so capped out. They don't really have a pivot point here. Evan Mobley, like, I just, even though the Cavs are in the conference finals right now, I just feel like this is going to be a referendum on the organization. If they have this James Harden experience too many times this postseason, they might be just pot committed to James Harden and feel like, well, we already acquired this guy, gave up Darius Garland for him. I guess we'll have to commit to this. But I would say with they have the highest payroll in the NBA, deep into the tax, and you're okay with this? I'm not so sure. They should be doubling down on the James Harden experience if he continues playing like this.
We'll be right back. Let's talk about some other teams, other news happening around the NBA. The Minnesota Timberwolves, Tim Connelly, their general manager, had his exit interview with the media earlier this week. And so after game seven, Naz Reid had talked about the moodiness on the team. Tim Connelly was asked a bit about that, and he had a quote that really stood out to me. He said, "Our emotional maturity has continued to be a thing that we have to get better at. If we can't improve internally, then we don't have the right people in the building." I would imagine this is about definitely one person in particular, and that's Julius Randle, above all else. I do think it's noteworthy as well that to tie this to what Minnesota might be thinking and what they might do, Conley did also say during the presser, "I like our sub 26 core." Well, who's older than 26 on the team? DiVincenzo, who ruptured his Achilles, Rudy Gobert, and Julius Randle. Those are some big money salaries. I think it's pretty clear to identify what Tim Connelly is thinking entering this offseason, Tom, with what they might be angling to do, and that is to find a way to change and overhaul this core around Anthony Edwards and the other younger guys on the team.
So let's talk about, Julius Randle has $33 million on the books next year and a player option for about $36 in 2027-28. Is there a team out there that has title aspirations or need a second star at the four position that might have relied a little too hard on Tobias Harris in the postseason expecting to get that every single
night? You're going to make me throw up, Tom. This is disgusting.
Can they get Julius Randle to Detroit and have... Hey, Kev, where are you going to trade him? Where are you going to trade Julius Randle at this point?
That's what the Pistons waited for. They waited to the summer to make a move for Julius Randle. God, Pistons fans, you might hate me now. Just you wait. If Detroit gets Julius Randle, you will not stand me. You might be knocking on my door. That's what you might be doing. I mean, geez.
Yeah, Julius Randle shooting it before. Imagine Isaiah Thompson, Julius Randle, Cade Cunningham, and Jalen Duren. Not Isaiah Thompson.
He might strangle Julius Randle.
So not the Pistons. Okay. Let's take him off the board. Where do the Minnesota Timberwolves dump Julius Randle? It's not going to be an easy thing if you can convince the Kings or some other poorly run organization to convince themselves that he is going to be a star player for you guys. Maybe they get off his money, but for them, I think Tim Connelly is smart enough to know, like, the moodiness and the presence in the locker room that Julius Randle has, you don't want that to diminish the energy that Anthony Edwards has out there. And I think Naz Reid being the one to say, hey, we got a mood problem, a moodiness problem. It's really interesting that he was the one to say that, because who would benefit the most of a Julius Randle trade or moving him away? It would be Naz Reid.
Yeah, it'd be Naz Reid and McDaniels. I think the both of them. Obviously, it also would depend on what the Wolves are getting back. And I think that's also the other thing Conley talked about. He said how Anthony Edwards, top five guy, best two-way guard in the league, but how can we find easier shots for him? How can we create easier looks for him? He's one of the best catch and shoot guys in the league. Let's get his job easier. So does that mean adding another guard, like a Conley upgrade, a younger Mike Conley, that type of thing? Or does it mean adding another big, beefy creator in the front court? Because the idea of Julius Randle makes sense. It's just he can't be Julius Randle. He can't be the answer there. And I think even defensively, you know, you saw Julius Randle defending Wemby a lot in the series. Not that it worked necessarily, but the idea of a guy who's 260 pounds, 6'9", 6'10", very strong, that's what OKC's angling for with Hartenstein to defend Wemby. That's what Minnesota angled for to defend him. That's why they had so many bigs for Jokic in these matchups. The NBA is a big league right now. The idea of Randle makes sense, and there's just not a lot of guys that check that box. So I'm very intrigued to see what directions Minnesota goes here. But what I'm also curious about, Tom, is Conley talked a lot about Yoan Berenguer, their young rookie French center. I wonder if that would indicate possibly moving Gobert as well, if that's a possibility. Are they going to try for Giannis again? I don't think they're going to have enough ammo to go get Giannis, but I would imagine they're going to try to flip Gobert into pieces, flip Randle into pieces. I just don't see how they get there, but I also don't know, like, what makes sense, you know, what makes sense besides Giannis if it's not him. I just, not a lot of answers out there for me. Even your Pistons idea, like, what are you going to get back from Detroit? I don't want Jalen Duren.
Yeah, tough. When you look at the chess moves that the Minnesota Timberwolves or the Denver Nuggets have on the board, you're looking at San Antonio and OKC going forward. That's why I posted when Minnesota got eliminated, just how quickly it changed from, hey, we got Anthony Edwards, Rudy Gobert, we just beat Denver, things are looking up for us, and then how quickly it can change where the window closes. And people were furious at me by suggesting the fact that Denver and Minnesota's windows are closed, and they're pointing to how young the core is in Minnesota. And I'm like, okay, well, look at the cores in OKC and San Antonio. Like, they're vastly better cores, young cores, than you have in Minnesota. So even if you want to say, hey, we got Jaden McDaniels, we got Anthony Edwards, we have a young core here that we can
we
build around.
Jaden, like, McDaniels.
We got Jaden McDaniels. Come on, it's Jaden McDaniels versus, like, Chet Holmgren and Dylan Harper and Stephon Castle. It's not even a comparison. Like, Jaden McDaniels is a really, really good super role player, like a guy who is long, able to score when you need it in pinches, but not a guy who's going to be a 25-point scorer like you can see for Stephon Castle and Dylan Harper one day. And so if you're the Minnesota Timberwolves and you're banking on that your young core is going to be superior to the one in OKC and in San Antonio, I got another thing coming for you. It's not going to happen that way. And so is it shut? Is it completely shut the title window for Anthony Edwards and Nikola Jokic? with San Antonio and all the assets and the youth and the fact that Wemby is on their team and not yours, it's just, I don't know what Denver and Minnesota does here. And maybe you open up talks with Julius Randle to go to Dallas. Maybe you take on Kyrie Irving as the point guard over Mike Conley. But again, where are you going to go with Julius Randle? If you're Dallas, it's going to be a full out reset. Klay Thompson, Kyrie Irving, I don't think are going to be on the roster next year. I don't think that's a great fit with Cooper Flagg, but if you're Dallas, you got to move off those contracts and do a full reset. Where are you going to go?
I mean, Tom, that's just so funny to me. Every team you mention as a destination for Randle, I'm just like, oh, no, don't do that. Don't do that to the Cooper rebuild. Don't do that. Don't do that to Detroit. You don't need him if you want to contend. Truthfully, Tom, I don't know what the team is for Julius Randle. I think the Julius Randle team is these teams. Not, I don't think it's a contender personally. I don't think it's a team like that. I think it's more these younger teams who just need a filler, a guy who's going to, he has a player option for next season and will be a one-off guy. You can flip him again at the trade deadline or something like that. I'm thinking like maybe Dallas, to your point. I'm thinking like New Orleans. I'm thinking Sacramento. I'm thinking teams like that, Brooklyn, more than anything else, like these younger teams that there's no incentive to bottom out anymore. You need somebody to get some buckets for you to create and put up numbers and maybe restore their value. I mean, keep in mind, Randle's a two-time All-NBA player. It's not like he hasn't had great seasons. It's just he's had such severe lows as a player, too. I look at those teams and think, oh, we'll buy Julius Randle for cheap and then flip them at the deadline to some team that's really desperate for a short-term fix. Yeah. That's what I'm thinking of with Julius Randle. But those teams I just mentioned, like, I don't know, like, is Trey Murphy or Herb Jones from New Orleans acquirable for you if you're Minnesota? Yeah. I don't know.
The heist of a century, man. That would be the heist of a century if they were able to get those 100%, guys.
100%. Like, well, who is the guy? Is it Zion? How about Zion? If you can't get Giannis, why not Julius Randle and some number of assets and go get Zion Williamson? How about that one? What do you think about that, Tom?
Well, Joe Dumars taking over the organization. A lot of times they want to, when a new executive comes in, they want to have their imprint, their team, their fingerprints on that team. So Zion, I think, is also a very intriguing off-season acquisition target. Yes. For, I mean, I've long felt that with the Clippers this season was like, what if they go get Zion or the Warriors or the Minnesota Timberwolves? That could be really intriguing, especially because when you look at the injury rates for Julius Randle, Rudy Gobert, and Anthony Edwards, the Minnesota staff, training staff, is superb keeping their stars healthy. So there is an element of, remember the Fountain of Youth in Phoenix, where it was like, if any star wants to kind of rehab and rehabilitate their health or their image, go to Phoenix and be able to do that. And you saw Grant Hill do it, or Amare, where it was like, man, these guys, they shouldn't be able to play at a high level with considering how bad their knees are. I feel like the Minnesota Timberwolves, with their track record on injuries, something like Zion could make a lot of sense. And for Joe Dumars and the organization there, I don't know. I think it's going to take a New Orleans, a Sacramento. Milwaukee was interesting, maybe at the deadline. I'm not so sure right now, but they don't have their pick next year. So maybe they decide, all right, let's just roll the ball out for Julius Randle. I don't see many good suitors, but that's, I think, a testament to how we appraise Julius Randle more so than like what other teams are doing. I think it says more about Julius Randle than the 30 teams in the league.
Yeah, I think that's spot on there. And let's talk about Dallas since you mentioned them as well. Jason Kidd was fired this week. The Mavericks' new front office made some changes in the front office and to the coaching staff. Jason Kidd is out. Masai Ujiri spoke about it the day after that was announced and said, you know, this is not about past decisions with the team. It's just about building moving forward. Very political answer. But I do think he said a couple interesting things during his presser that could indicate what their direction could be this offseason. Masai said, every decision we are going to make here is going to be future-based. We have a 19-year-old generational player on our roster. We're not going to make decisions based on winning today. He said that up front, and he also said how it's important for them to have organizational alignment. Clearly, that's part of hiring your own coach. I don't think there's any surprises here with firing Kidd, as a new GM often would, is bringing in their own guy, their own head coach. But I do wonder with Dallas, Tom, my first thought was how Dallas, maybe this means like a PJ Washington could be available, a Daniel Gafford, some of their veteran players that could help contenders. However, if you look at the way Masai Ujiri built his teams in Denver and Toronto, Toronto, when Masai was really at his peak from a drafting standpoint in the mid-2010s or so, they were competitive Raptors rosters with a bunch of young guys on the back end of the bench. Norman Powell, Fred VanVleet, guys like that were developing behind the scenes while the team was winning 40-something games. So I wonder if that might actually be what he's talking about when it comes to everything's future-based, trying to compete around Cooper rather than bottoming out. But it's hard to say, because I think if you do put PJ Washington and some of these guys on the table, you could get some pretty good assets and still be a competitive team with the other moves that you make.
Yeah, a lot of the talk about Rookie of the Year was that Colin Knipl was a winning player on a winning team and was part of, you know, yes, he led the league in threes, and not the case for Cooper Flagg. With he wasn't a part of a winning team, they weren't really doing much this season. Jason Kidd played him at point guard for about half the season and then bailed on that after a while and realized, yeah, we should probably get a point guard out there. Now he doesn't have a job. How far away is Cooper Flagg from winning, like being a 500 team? I think he's pretty close. I think at the tail end of last season, I think Cooper Flagg, even at 18, 19 years old, I don't think he's far away from being a positive player. He lives too much in the mid-range right now for my taste. His jumper is still in that Paolo Banchero area where it's just he can get that shot off and it's impressive at his size, but I still would like to see it go in a whole lot more. Question is for Masai Ujiri is this with the new draft lotto rules, are you fine with being a 40-win team? Because that essentially is the same thing as a team that would be bottom five in the standings in previous years. So I think, yeah, if they can get off Klay Thompson and Kyrie Irving, I think they do it tomorrow, right? It is different, though, like you mentioned, with PJ Washington, who's 27, Najee Marshall, who's 28, and Daniel Gafford, who's the same age. Those pieces, I think they might stick around and just help them develop and keep that core around Cooper Flagg. But clearly, I think any of the old guard, the Jason Kidd, Klay Thompson, and Kyrie Irving, I think those players that were part of that Nico Harrison, Luka Doncic era, I think they're gone.
I would think that would be the right thing to do. I do. I mean, I think like trading Kyrie at this point would make a lot of sense to me. Trading Klay obviously would as well. I'm sure he'd probably invite being traded elsewhere too. But like with Kyrie Irving particularly, not a lot of time left on his contract, coming off a major injury, missed all of last season. I don't think with him having 1 year guaranteed remaining and then a player option for the following year when he'll be 35 years old, keeping him necessarily outweighs the advantage of having a young guard that you draft or whatever you get back for him and somebody who can grow and get experience with Cooper Flagg. This is such a guard-heavy draft. There are so many good quality guards. And I think for Dallas, it's a good opportunity to take one or two of those guys and see how they grow. And while also still getting some type of value back for Kyrie Irving from a team that would value having a 34-year-old former champion guard. So I think for Dallas, that's definitely number one thing on my mind. And you said, Tom, how, you know, from a team building perspective, not bottoming out anymore, being, you know, sort of a competitive team and you're in that range with the best odds. I think you're going to see a lot of teams aiming for that now instead of aiming for the bottom. And that's going to create more competition, but it also is going to make it fascinating to see how teams do decide to rebuild what's the approach going to be for the Milwaukee Bucks, for example, when it comes to trading Giannis Antetokounmpo? If bottoming out, well, also they don't have all of their first, their own picks, but even if they did, if bottoming out isn't the solution, what is the path teams take? Are you just trying to get a bunch of first round picks? Do you want more swaps instead of outright first? So you have the optionality. How are teams going to rebuild now, assuming these new 3-2-1 lottery rules are approved a week from now when owners vote for it on May 27th? I think it's going to be a fascinating question, and we're going to get a couple of, I think, first real test cases this offseason with Milwaukee, with Giannis, with Dallas as well, with Kyrie Irving and some of the vets that they could put on the table as well. I'm excited to see the approach teams take. There's not a lot of clarity. Everybody you talk to around the league, and I'm sure this is similar in your experience too with convos you're having, people are like, yeah, I don't know. We'll find out. We're going to see what teams do. I don't think there's a clear-cut solution with how teams are going to approach this now. I think it's going to make team building, it's going to widen the skill gap between great front offices and poor front offices. It's what my main gut feeling. Less luck, more strategy.
Well, there's so much more luck now, though. That's the thing, is like, how do you separate the luck of a good GM when they trade a pick and it could either be 20th in the draft, or let's just say 16th in the draft, or number one? You know, like, there's so much of this that we do Monday morning quarterbacking where how could they possibly have traded that pick? It just landed number one overall. What a dumb move by that trade 3 years ago. But that same trade, just by the sheer luck of the new lottery reform, that same trade could end up as a 16th pick. And that variance, I think, is going to be really troubling for some GMs to be like, I got to put some protections in this pick because it could either be 16th or it could be first. And that's going to be my job. And I think you're going to see a lot of teams holding on to their picks to just see how this lottery reform changes things. And I know it's one thing to look at a spreadsheet, but it's another to give up a pick that ends up being Cooper Flagg, or give up a pick that becomes AJ DeBonsa, or a number one pick that becomes Victor Wembanyama. Whoever those guys are down the line, I think GMs are going to be really scared to put those picks in there into a deal. I think you're going to see a lot more pick protections because to just eat into and mitigate those downside risks. So I think there is going to be a team that just looks at this and says, best case scenario on those picks is prime Giannis. And if we can get prime Giannis right now, I'm willing to stomach that risk that it becomes a lotto win on those picks. I think you're going to see a team that's going to just push all their chips in the middle and get Giannis.
I think so too. I think there's going to be at least one team out there that's going to go all in on Giannis and say, this guy's 1 year removed from being third in MVP voting, still one of the best players in the world. And we're not going to let 1 year of him having some injuries and whining his way out of Milwaukee and this with this ugly breakup, we're not going to let that change the fact that this guy's still a dominant force who can go toe-to-toe against the best players in the world, Jokic, Wemby, all of them, all these big, big players that are really hard to match up against. Giannis is one of the few that can. I think you're going to see a team go all in for Giannis, for sure. And for Milwaukee, that might make rebuilding easy. Who knows with the volume of picks that you end up getting. But I do think I want to note the lucky versus strategic part, Tom. When I say strategy, I mean the fact you no longer have the crutch of just being bad. You no longer have the crutch of just being at the worst record and you're going to be fifth worst pick in the worst case scenario. You no longer even the past prior odds with 25% and number one. That's not an option anymore. That now it's about what can we do from a pro personnel decision perspective? What can we do from a compiling different swaps in terms to increase our chances of getting lucky on draft night? What are those types of moves the teams can make to improve? What if you don't get lucky on draft night? The teams that draft smart in the 7 spot or the 16 spot or the 20 spot, what edge do those teams have over these organizations that are quite poor at making those choices? I think that's where the gap will widen. Of course, luck will still be a big element, and the draft suddenly will become far more random for sure. But that's what I mean, like when I talk about the strategy aspects from team building.
Yeah, I think incompetence is going to be punished way more in this system. Be bad and everyone else is trying to lose, you're going to be a bottom three team and you're going to be in that draft relegation zone. So you can't get away with just being Sacramento for two decades and get rewarded for it. In this new system, I think if you're incompetent and you're not able to, you know, rely and fall back, like you said, on the welfare system that we have with the draft, which is like, hey, if you're bad and you're not even trying, then we're just going to give you the best asset in the NBA, which is a Victor Wembanyama on a rookie scale contract or a Cooper Flagg on a rookie scale contract. Well, you have them for 7-8 years at a cost controlled number. And so that incentive system is out the window. And I credit Adam Silver. Initially, I did not think that they were going to be able to have a fix for tanking, outright tanking. I think there is going to be, if they get rid of the whole playoff teams are not going to be part of the lottery, if they get rid of that little hitch that I see, I know we both disagree on this, is like, I just think that if you go down 0-2 in a series, I think you're going to see a lot of teams just pull the plug. But if they get rid of that and just have the lotto for teams that aren't in the playoffs, I think this is a pretty good system that they have proposed. I just feel bad for poorly run. I don't feel bad. You know what? I don't feel bad for poorly run teams.
I don't either.
These are run by billionaires. I don't feel bad about that. If you want to win in the NBA, you got to have a winning front office and a winning culture and a winning player development program. And if you don't, I think that gap is going to be a lot larger between the haves and have nots.
Yeah. I mean, and we'll see. We'll see if it even passes. That vote is next Wednesday. Once the Board of Governors meets that proposal that the NBA puts on the table. We haven't gotten an actual update. I haven't gotten specific word on if any changes are going to come from that. I'm sure we'll find out in the coming days or over the coming week at the least once the owners do vote. I'm looking forward to that, Tom. Tom, I'm looking forward to game two tonight of Knicks versus Cavaliers. I can't wait already for game three of Spurs versus Thunder. It's the best time of year. Conference finals, NBA finals around the corner, NBA draft, and just a couple days more, over a month from now. Woo-wee! Let's go, baby. This is the best year time of the year, Tom.
It is. It is. And we got two great series, man. The first time in NBA history we had game one of the conference finals, both going to overtime. It's awesome. And I appreciate the central time zone starts for the OKC San Antonio series for us East Coasters. This is really nice in the Western Conference. We're not having to stay up till 2 a.m. Watching these games. So it's been a lot of fun, man. I can't wait to see how the rest of the Western Conference finals and Eastern Conference finals plays out.
Me too, Tom. Thank you so much for joining me today. Be sure everybody check out The Big Number, check out Tom the Finder, check out Basketball Illuminati. You're on 400 different shows. So you do it all. Tom, thanks so much for joining me. Thank you everybody on YouTube for watching us live as well. We'll be back again with my podcast on next Monday and Tuesday. Tom will have his show on Wednesday as well. And Tom and I will be back a week from now on Thursday. See you guys. Thanks for watching.